A lot of kids grow up participating in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts. I remember selling my fair share of Thin Mints, but it's not for everyone. The uniforms, cookie sales, and camping aren't that appealing to some families. So recently, other Scout-like groups have been sprouting up around the country, and their focus is on technology, do-it-yourself, or DIY projects. These groups are co-ed, and like traditional scouting organizations, if you master a skill, you get a patch. John Kalish reports.
Ace Monster Toys is an adult hackerspace in Oakland, California, where members share high-tech tools. Normally, there are grown-ups here working on electronics or woodworking projects, but on a Sunday afternoon, this place is overrun by 50 kids and their parents for the bi-monthly gathering of a group called Hacker Scouts.
If you are doing a judo bot, you can head down the stairs into the room at the bottom of the stairs. Compressed air rockets at this table.
The kids in Hacker Scouts are not breaking into computer networks. They make things with their hands, and at this particular meeting, they're learning to solder and building judo bots, small robots made out of wooden popsicle sticks. On this warm fall day, 10-year-old Alicia Davis is wearing a wool hat she had knitted. As her dad stands nearby, she sits sewing an LED bracelet with conductive thread.
I've been sewing on little felt pieces with this. The battery will power the LEDs and light up. It's pretty cool.
One of the parents active in organizing the Hacker Scouts is Chris Cook, who serves as the president of the adult hackerspace where the Hacker Scouts meet.
We've expressly targeted the 8 to 14-year-olds. It's old enough where they're ready to start developing skills. They're not so old that they've already been set in their ways and they're more interested in what their peer groups are doing. So we felt like the right kind of time to expose them to how to craft with their hands, how to take things from a computer and put them into the physical world.
The Hacker Scouts don't wear uniforms, but soon they'll be able to earn something akin to merit badges. The badges are made by Adafruit Industries in New York. Becky Stern and Lamore Freed showed me a few of their favorites.
I like the quadcopter badge, so your aerial quadcopter, and then this is the high-altitude balloon badge.
This is the learn to solder badge, so you can learn to solder. We have the dumpster diving badge for when you get dirty but get some free stuff.
The thought of a bunch of Hacker Scouts dumpster diving may be unsettling, but recycling and repurposing are big with hacker groups. A new DIY website for kids is awarding badges for salvaging and foraging. 11-year-old Grace McFadden of Madison, Connecticut, used a recycled juice carton as the soles of a pair of felt slippers she made and got herself a salvager badge.
Right now I really like making paper airplanes and origami. I have a whole fleet of paper airplanes.
And how did you learn how to make them?
Well, I have this app on my iPod, and I just looked online.
McFadden shares photos of the stuff she makes on DIY.org, a San Francisco-based website that awards more than 40 badges for skills ranging from bike mechanic to special effects wizard. The website has started producing how-to videos for DIY projects.
Shoebox harp. You'll need a shoebox, some scissors, a pencil, and a few rubber bands.
There are now 32,000 kids registered with DIY.org, which plans to organize local clubs around the country. The website has an animated anthem exhorting kids to build, make, hack, and grow. DIY.org's chief creative officer, Isaiah Saxon, says they plan to create the digital equivalent of a scouting handbook for mobile devices.
We hope that people's smartphones are eventually the Swiss Army knife of our movement, and that you go out into the woods and can point your phone at a tree and peel it open and learn about the wood underneath. And we can provide visual guides and amazing experiences on the fly through these powerful handheld computers.
The Hacker Scout movement is spreading around the country. Seattle now has a science-focused group called Geek Scouts, and a couple of tribes, not troops, of Maker Scouts are being formed in Milwaukee and Charleston. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This falls into the category called first world problems. People who bring books onto airplanes face trouble when the book is on an e-reader like a Kindle or an iPad or a Nook, which they cannot read as the plane takes off or approaches its landing. That is the rule of the Federal Aviation Administration, which is now under pressure to change it. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
If you've flown at all, you've heard the flight attendant announce it's time to stow those portable electronic devices. Anything with an on or off switch must be turned off. If you fly a lot, like Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, you hear it a lot. Even the flight attendants, she says, are getting tired of saying it.
Many flight attendants have expressed frustration at how much time they spend on turn it off, we're about to land, turn it off, have you shut that down? Have you really shut it down? Sir, I've asked you to shut it down. And I think they are frustrated with that.
So McCaskill, mindful of the frustrations of flight attendants and passengers alike, recently wrote the Federal Aviation Administration, urging that it allow the use of portable electronic devices for, quote, the full duration of the flight. McCaskill says the FAA's current policy on e-readers and the like is anachronistic.
We really don't have any factual basis to support that they are a safety concern. And I'm big on getting rid of regulations that make no sense. And I think this is one that it's just time we take a really close look at it.
We're not talking about cell phones here. Those are transmitting devices, and no officials are calling for their use just yet. McCaskill's isn't the only letter the FAA has received of late urging action on e-readers. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Julius Genachowski wrote the FAA earlier this month, pointing out that mobile devices are, quote, increasingly interwoven in our daily lives, that they help drive economic growth and boost U.S. competitiveness. The two agencies are working together to study the safety of the devices. Commercial pilot Patrick Smith, who writes the online blog AskThePilot.com, says the safety issue is more about physics than electronics.
As I understand it, any electronic interference that can be caused by these devices is really negligible to beyond negligible. And all along, it's been more about them being a piece of hardware and a potential projectile, not about interference.
Smith points out that a number of airlines are now allowing pilots to use the e-devices in the cockpit in lieu of those traditional big black bags of manuals and publications. But another pilot, Kevin Hyatt, who heads the Flight Safety Foundation, says the FAA, while moving slowly on the issue, is right to be cautious. He says there are so many different types of devices, as well as many different types of aircraft, the agency has no choice but to conduct thorough testing.
What the concern is that we don't know with the Kindle or the iPad or the Nook or any of those types of devices just exactly what they might be emitting. Have they been turned off or turned on for airplane mode? And the other part about it is, have they been damaged? Sometimes when you damage one of those types of devices, it then alters the way it works, and then it might be sending out something that nobody knows how it would affect the cockpit.
But critics of the FAA's go slow approach say there has been thorough, if unofficial, testing by passengers who either mistakenly or intentionally failed to turn off their devices when told to do so by flight attendants without ill effect. The FAA would not comment for the record, but officials say they are bringing together all the stakeholders, from flight attendants to manufacturers, to figure out how to go forward. Senator McCaskill says if the agency doesn't adopt what she calls common sense changes soon, she's ready to introduce legislation to force it to act. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
And what we see on the internet these days is actually increasingly fresh. This year, there's lots more to watch online than old TV shows and cat videos. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on the explosion of professionally produced videos made just for the internet.
Mark Suster says he knows where the internet is going.
People in America watch on average 5.3 hours of television per day. We know what the future of the internet's going to be. You're not going to change media consumption patterns. It's going to be a great big video platform.
Suster has bet a lot of money on that. He's a venture capitalist who's invested millions of dollars in companies that create professional online video. Like this.
Hello, Internet. I just wanted to say hi and introduce the one and only Snoop Dogg to YouTube.
Yes, sir.
Snoop Dogg, along with Kasim G, is being produced by a YouTube network called Maker Studios. Suster is an investor in it, and this year his bet has started to pay off.
3.5 years ago, there were no employees. Maker Studios alone now employs more than 300 people. I think by next year, Maker Studios will find itself north of $100 million in revenue.
Suster says the overall total views every month for Maker Studio videos is 2 billion. The company is an umbrella for a lot of different producers. It cross-promotes them and gets ads for the videos on YouTube. This year saw the launch of some new multi-channel networks like MeToo. MeToo is a bilingual network that focuses on lifestyle topics like recipes, makeup, money management.
I think that this has really been a transformative year.
Doug Greif is the co-founder of MeToo. Until this year, he spent his year focused on traditional TV.
It's really fascinating for somebody like myself to now see everybody in our business here in Los Angeles and in Hollywood talking about, well, what are you doing on the web? It used to be not particularly cool.
Now it's very cool. Greif says since launching MeToo last April, its videos have been viewed upwards of 800 million times. And as much as traditional Hollywood may be talking about online, Greif says MeToo is making new stars out of people who started out making home videos.
It's really astounding that you have these little cottage industries that are popping up around the world. The majority of them are women, many of them are moms and wives, and they are running these quite successful businesses from their homes.
Among MeToo's stars is Chris Ordaz.
Hola, chicas. Bienvenidas a My Makeup Corner. ¿Cómo están?
Hello.
Ordaz is a mom working at home, and her down-home good looks and practical makeup advice has garnered her a big audience and a Honda sponsorship. Another big online player is Hulu. The company has a subscription service that recycles old TV shows. But this year, Hulu launched an original drama.
All right, number three. There's going to be a film crew following us from now on. It's for some internet thing or something. I don't know.
We started with Battleground in February. It's a political drama, but very funny.
Andy Forsall is a senior vice president at Hulu. He says the web is a place to experiment. In the case of Battleground, Fox turned it down because of its mix of politics and humor.
To networks, that just doesn't seem to fit. It doesn't fit into any of the models they have. And it was just a really interesting show and very well done.
Hulu backed 5 of its own shows in 2012, and it has more coming this year. Netflix, the other site known for streaming other people's shows, had its first original show this year. Investor Mark Suster says these web-based companies realize that this is the way forward.
Their future cannot be tied to just aggregating content produced by studios. They have to have some original programming.
One of the best barometers of internet videos may be YouTube's top 10 list. Last year, only 3 of the top videos were made by pros. This year, 7 of the top videos are professionals. There are probably a few dog and cat stars who are bummed out about this. But for the rest of us, the year to come may bring more variety to our online menus. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It gave an unheralded edge to President Obama's re-election campaign. It provokes concerns about intrusive data gathering by the government, and it's behind those irritating personalized ads that pursue us around the web. It's called big data, and it's the term that our linguist Jeff Nomberg has chosen as his 2012 Word of the Year.
Big data hasn't made any of the words of the year lists I've seen so far. That's probably because it didn't get the wide public exposure of items like Frankenstorm or Fiscal Cliff or YOLO. But it had a huge surge in venues like Wired and The Economist, and it was the buzz of Silicon Valley and Davos. And if the phrase wasn't as familiar to many people as Etch-a-Sketch or 47%, big data had as much to do with Obama's victory as they did. Whatever it's explicitly called, the big data phenomenon has been all over the news. It's behind a lot of our concerns about intrusions on our privacy, whether from the government's anti-terrorist data sweeps or the ads that track us as we wander around the web. It has even turned statistics into a sexy major. So if you haven't heard the phrase yet, there's still plenty of time. It'll be around a lot longer than Gangnam Style. It's a good name, too. I always want to pronounce it with a plosive B the way Carl Sagan would. Big data, as in billions of bits. That's about right for what people are calling the age of exabytes. Exabytes are what comes after petabytes, which comes after terabytes, which comes after gigabytes. If the numbers are hard to grasp, think of it this way. If you started stacking up those old 64K floppies until you got to 500 exabytes, you'd have a pile that stretched from here to someplace really far away. Big data is no more exact a notion than big hair. Nothing magic happens when you get to the 18th or 19th zero. After all, digital data has been accumulating for decades in quantities that always seemed unimaginably vast at the time, whether they were followed by a K or an M or a G. An exponential curve looks just as overwhelming wherever you get on board. And anyway, nobody really knows how to quantify this stuff precisely. Whatever the sticklers say, data isn't a plural noun like pebbles. It's a mass noun like dust. What's new is the way data is generated and processed. It's like dust in that regard, too. We kick up clouds of it wherever we go. Cell phones and cable boxes, Google and Amazon, Facebook and Twitter, the barcodes on milk cartons, and the RFID chip that whips you through the toll plaza. Each of them captures a sliver of what we're doing, and nowadays they're all calling home. It's only when all those little chunks are aggregated that they turn into big data. Then the software called analytics can scour it for patterns. Epidemiologists watch for blips in Google queries to localize flu outbreaks. Economists use them to spot shifts in consumer confidence. Police analytics comb over crime data looking for hot zones. Security agencies comb over travel and credit card records looking for possible terrorists. This was the year we held the first big data election. The Republicans may have had more money, but the Obama campaign had the best voter data and analytics. That gave them an edge in identifying likely supporters and finding the best ways to reach what they called low-information independents, which turned out to include running ads on Jimmy Kimmel and the rerun cable network TV Land. And it was big data analytics that Nate Silver used to correctly predict the election outcome in all 50 states, skunking the pundits in the process. It's the amalgamation of all that personal data that makes it possible for businesses to target their customers online and tailor their sales pitches to individual consumers. You idly click on an ad for a pair of red sneakers one morning, and they'll stalk you to the end of your days. It makes me nostalgic for the age when cyberspace promised a liberating anonymity. I think of that famous 1993 New Yorker cartoon by Peter Steiner. On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. Now it's more like, on the internet, everybody knows what brand of dog food you buy. Actually, it's more worrisome when they get your brand of dog food wrong. In some circles, big data has spawned a cult of infallibility, a vision of prediction obviating understanding, and math trumping science. In a manifesto in Wired, Chris Anderson wrote, "With enough data, the numbers speak for themselves." The trouble is that you don't always know when to believe them. When you've got algorithms weighing hundreds of factors over a huge data set, you can't really know why they come to a particular decision or whether it really makes sense. When I was working on systems like these years ago at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, we used to talk about a 95% solution. So what if Amazon's algorithms decide that I'd be interested in Celine Dion's greatest hits, as long as they get 19 out of 20 recommendations right? But those odds are less reassuring when the algorithms are selecting candidates for the no-fly list. The phrase big data may not endure. 20 years from now, we'll probably be measuring information in humongo bytes. People will be amused to recall an age when a couple of exabytes were considered big data, the way we laugh to think of a time when $15,000 a year sounded like big money. But 19 out of 20 is probably still going to be a good hit rate for these algorithms. And people will still feel the need to sort out causes from correlations. It's something you can never stop asking. What are patterns for?
Jeff Nunberg teaches at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Henry Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
And now it's time for one last thing, our science surprise.
All you fashionistas, listen up. Snakeskin is so last year. Scientists say the fabric of the future is lightweight, almost 10 times stronger than nylon, and comes from the sea, from hagfish, long worm-like creatures that produce buckets of slime.
They have these very specialized slime glands down both sides of their body. These slime glands actually shoot condensed mucus out into the seawater. There are tens of thousands of silk-like fibers running throughout the slime.
That's Douglas Fudge, a biologist at the University of Guelph in Ontario. He's been experimenting with ways to spin protein fibers, silk, essentially, from the hagfish slime.
The individual fibers are really tiny. They're only about a micron in diameter, about 1/60th the diameter of a human hair. You could hang a weight that is almost a gram off of one of those fibers.
That's like hanging a paperclip off this microscopic thread. And this strong, stringy slime actually serves as a defensive coat for the hagfish.
We think that the slime is very well designed to stick on the gills of gill-breathing predators like sharks, and it could actually suffocate them.
And best of all, you don't even need hagfish for hagfish slime.
I don't really want to be in the business of hagfish farming or hagfish ranching.
Just as bacteria have been engineered to manufacture proteins like insulin, they could also be tweaked to pump out hagfish slime. But who's going to buy a hagfish sweater? It's all in the marketing. 100% sea silk sounds pretty soft, doesn't it? For Science Friday, I'm Christopher Intagliata.
That's about all the time we have for this hour. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Denise Chow, our associate producer. Sam Plato, our production assistant. John Chang is our intern, and this is his last day with us, John. We're going to miss you. Thanks for being so part of our Science Friday family. We wish you good luck in your next endeavor. And if you missed any part of this program, would like to hear it again, if you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast. We have audio and video ones on iTunes and Android apps. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can join our mailing list there and get special bennies from doing that also. If you want to send mail the old-fashioned classic way, we'd love to hear from you. Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can leave us some mail there, too. Have a great weekend and Merry Christmas to you if you're celebrating that. I'm Ira Flatto in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Say the words high-tech startup, and chances are you picture a world that's mostly white, male, and set in Silicon Valley. There's been a lot of talk this year about how to get more women entrepreneurs into the male-dominated world of tech, and today we take you to Nairobi, Kenya, a growing tech hub for the African continent that's also trying to rethink geek culture. NPR's Gregory Warner reports.
When a group of women computer programmers in Kenya needed a name for their ladies-only club, they took their inspiration from Japanese cult film.
So Akira is a Japanese word. It means energy and intelligence, and we are energetic and intelligent chicks.
Judith Uyghur is the president of Akira Chicks.
C-H-I-X.
A group like Akira Chicks would have been unthinkable even 5 years ago, but Kenya is making a big push toward IT, part of the country's plan for achieving middle-class status by the year 2030. The country's laid hundreds of miles of fiber optic cable. IBM and Google have come here to set up shop. The city even has plans for a $7 billion technology hub just outside the capital. But you need more than broadband and tech giants and even money to launch a local tech industry. You also need a culture of computer geeks. That's where Judith and her collective Akira Chicks comes in. They want to make sure that the girl geeks are encouraged as much as the guys.
You're the oddball. I mean, just because of your gender, already you're the oddball.
Because it turns out that in Kenya, just like in Silicon Valley, the problem with getting more women in tech is that there aren't more women in tech.
There are probably other women in tech who are alone, and, you know, they think they're the weird ones, but maybe if enough of us weird ones meet together, you know, it wouldn't be so weird anymore.
Susan Aguya is also an Akira chick. She grew up on a farm in western Kenya without a computer, but she had an uncle who worked in Nairobi, and when he came home for the holidays, he would haul his entire workstation in the car back with him. The monitor, the CPU, the keyboard, and set it all up again in Susan's living room.
So he'll bring it over, we use it, and then he'll go back with it.
So what did you do in the times when you didn't have a computer?
So in the times I didn't have a computer, there were books that he left. Books about what is a computer, parts of a computer, what is a ROM, what is a RAM, just really basics.
When she got to university, she majored in information technology. One of the striking things about Kenya is that even impoverished farmers have cell phones. So Susan had this idea for a mobile phone app that would help farmers like her parents. The app would allow them to check the prices of crops with text messaging, skipping the middleman.
Yeah, corrupt middleman. Let's say skipping the corrupt middleman.
But Susan was one of only 10 women in her department of 80. It's about the same ratio you'd find in a computer science class at Stanford. Susan's teachers doubted her ability to actually program this app she'd thought up.
In my culture, it's like men can only communicate with men. And I was like, okay, then if I could share this passion, like try and explain to the person this is what I want to do, it's only a woman who could understand me better.
It wasn't until her third year she met a computer researcher at the same university. Jessica Colasso says she bumped into Susan in the hallway.
I remember when I met her in the corridor, Susan was really shy. She was like, excuse me, are you Jessica Colasso?
So she invited me, was like, come meet other women who are also who also have a passion like you, but they want to relate out to other women who don't know that this exists.
Susan started spending some Saturday mornings with Jessica and other women, snipping code, poring through hacker cookbooks, informal gatherings that became the Akira Chicks, while Susan graduated and turned her mobile phone idea into a company called M-Farm. At 25 years old, she now has 18 people working for her and 7,000 African farmers using her app. Just one floor up from Susan's office, you find a kind of oasis of geekdom, a gathering space for Nairobi's tech community called the iHub. It feels like any sort of hackerspace you'd find in San Francisco or New York City. It's got comfy couches, fast Wi-Fi, and cappuccinos served by a barista named Miss Rose. But the techies you meet here are not trying to come up with the next Facebook or another app to share your photos. They're solving local problems, like there's an app that brings math and reading prep to remote village schools by cell phone. There's an app that lets Kenyans who don't have computers do their online shopping, again, by cell phone. There's another app that's a kind of micro-insurance that measures the rain falling at cell phone towers and then automatically distributes money to farmers when there's a drought. All applications aimed at the developing world started by women. Judith the Uyghur says they're sending a message to the next wave of girl geeks.
We need them to see that we are doing it and we enjoy it. You know, you don't find many African women looking for the spotlight. Most people tend to hide their awesomeness.
So the best time to carve a spot for women in geek culture, she says, is when there isn't much of a geek culture yet. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.